Hi, I'm Tim Hernandez. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. I'm really excited to share our most recent interview with Willa Carroll, the author and fantastic poet of the book Nerve Chorus. It's out with The Word Works. She's based out in New York, so she's going to be calling in. But before we invite her to this interview, I actually want to talk a little bit about just what I know about Willa. You know, I had the opportunity to meet with her in Bennington, Vermont, as we both attended the Bennington Writing Seminars there. In our classrooms or in our workshops, she was always so one of those poets that you would look at and almost make you want to kind of rip up your own journals and give up writing altogether. She just, her work is so charged and emotional and visceral, and just the kind of writing that she doesn't waste a single word. And I think I want to read to you from one of the blurbs on the back of her book. This blurb comes to you by way of Tracy Smith, who is the United States Poet Laureate. She writes, "These nimble poems grapple with what it means to belong to a body, a family, a country. With rigor and dark wit, Carroll conjures the exhilarating terror of moving through one's life with nothing but flesh holding back disaster." And with that, we'll just get right into the interview. This is Willa Carroll on Words on a Wire. Willa Carroll's poems have appeared in Agni, Los Angeles Review of Books, Quarterly Journal, Tin House, and many, many other places. She was the winner of the Narrative's third annual poetry contest and Tupelo Quarterly's TQ7 Poetry Prize. She's a former experimental dancer and actress. She's collaborated with performers, multimedia artists, and her filmmaker husband on text-based projects. She holds an MFA from Bennington College and lives in New York City. Willa Carroll, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
Oh, are you kidding? It's really an honor, and it's sort of something that I've been looking to a long time coming, to be able to talk to you about your book and your poetry. Because, well, first I should tell our listeners, your book is titled Nerve Chorus, and it is a fantastic collection of poetry out with The Word Works. So first, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And like I was going to say is, you know, I've been a fan of your work since it's first come upon my radar, which was back in our time at Bennington College in Vermont. Back in, I guess, 2009 to 2011. So,
yeah.
Yeah, we'd be in workshops, and I was always amazed and stunned by your poetry and always left going, damn, I want to write like that.
Oh, I felt that way about your work.
No, I mean, I'm not even
still
exaggerating.
Do.
I'm not exaggerating. That is exactly the truth. That is really the truth. And then it's just been receiving such fantastic accolades and reviews. I mean, the blurbs in the back by Tracy Smith and Tim Liu, just some fantastic folks supporting your work. How's the reception been on your end? I mean, how are you feeling about the reception?
I've been really blown away by the support. So many friends sharing their enthusiasm and sharing support for the work in various ways. And it's been humbling, and I'm so grateful.
Yeah. In the introduction to this interview, I actually read to our listeners a description of your book, which was from, I think it was Becca Lachman's fantastic review on,
Consequence Magazine.
Consequence Magazine. Yeah, here it is. Yeah. I have it. Consequence Magazine. Fantastic review she did of it, and just a great description of the book. But in your own words, how would you just describe briefly the subject and concept for this book?
Well, for me, the book spotlights the body, the self, family, and also society, and it tries to interrogate inequality. And
right.
The poems try to take on gender, class, race, war, gun violence, and capitalistic greed. And
right.
Some of the poems deal with sexual violation. Many others, you know, the bulk of the book, many poems in the book document and grapple with my father's fatal asbestos exposure.
Right.
You know, a chorus of artists and pop culture figures also inhabit the book, keeping things lively.
Yeah. And you know what? I would say that it really does keep things lively, because the book is a kind of intimate chorus of, you know, of your life and your experiences and life through your lens. And, you know, I really did feel these sort of tender moments throughout in some of the poems, not only about your father, but also about your mother or about an uncle or a relative, you know, these working class folks who you really kind of just, you know, with your poet's eye and your poet's pen are paying attention and really kind of writing, I think, a tribute or homage to them even. And I felt that throughout. But then you're right. It was sprinkled with these kind of pop culture, you know, I think of like Yoga with Monica Lewinsky, you know, these really funny anecdotes, but they're just fantastic poems as well. And I found myself laughing unexpectedly at times when probably the book needed it most, you know. It just was fantastic. So why don't we start by asking you to share a poem from this collection?
Great. Okay, I'd like to read Chorus of Excisions. I think it, you know, sort of speaks to our political moment.
Absolutely.
Chorus of Excisions. Cut the drill, viscous leak. Cut salt from earth, lead from water, drones from firmament. Insert this kiss, our natural habitat. Cut asbestos from imploding buildings, ban it from the wind. Delete half-lives, hazmat suits, atomic tourism. Erase phosphorus clouds, cut nerve agents. Cut duct tape and anaphora of ammo from goose flesh. Insert your touch, soft impact. Insert rush of pearled seed. Cut the stuff with strychnine and speed. Cut short the cutting speech. Undercut bunk facts, craft theatrics. Excise us, bodies up for grope, strapped in the pink, dodging the grab. Strike down that crooked flag, deep slur on the wind. Shred caution tape to ribbons. Cut cluster munitions and billowing green chlorine gas. Insert your Lazarus comeback. Cut to the chase and chastened, bloodhound, technicolor face. Cut scene to celluloid rings on the cutting room floor. Insert longing, my lifelong occupation. Sniff the roses, lacquered and maverick, pesticide blitz. Censor the shot from time of a charred face in an armored truck. Split bitter pill, crush to smithereens. Delete barricades for the fleeing, cut no holes in their hulls. Insert refuge, sanctuary in your scent. Insert flesh memory. Extract bit rot, data decay. Cut coal debris and PCBs from waterways. Rewind glacial rift. Shred empire. Strike gilded set with my father's hammer.
And if you're just tuning in to Words on a Wire, you're listening to the voice of poet Willa Carroll reading from her fantastic new collection of poetry titled Nerve Chorus. And that poem was called Chorus of Excisions. Just a fantastic, really charged. I recall most about your poetry is that it's so charged, you know, the language is so tight and it's just, just so much energy in that and very visceral as well. You know, how much of that do you feel that kind of tendency to lean toward the visceral maybe in your poetry is maybe informed or influenced by, you know, your upbringing, you know, by either the working class family or just your upbringing in general? Or does it have any bearing on him?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting question. I don't know if I've ever thought about that directly. Mm-hmm. I always think of the visceral quality being connected to my background in dance and
right.
experimental theater and performance. But actually, now that you mention that, I think there is a connection. There's a very direct quality in language with, mm-hmm. you know, working class people. It's like there's not right. a lot of time to sit around and pontificate. I mean, right. usually, you know, my dad and I, most of our relationship transpired in his pickup truck, you know, him
yes.
driving me places and that cab that was full of sawdust and asbestos. And so there was a directness, you know, we were right. driving from one place to another in this, you know, northern industrial city of Rochester, New York. And right. So there's a to the point, you know, quality with language,
right.
I think, you know, in my family and where I'm from.
Right. And, you know, that's one of the other things I wanted to ask you about was just, you know, the physicality of these poems, I think, or at least the language in these poems, you know, how much of that is tied to your work with the body, you know, in performance, in dance, in acting, and then again, tied also to your background and your upbringing. I know that I also come from a working class family, and I know that for me, I always try to look for the physical aspects of language and writing and how I'm engaged as a poet in the world. And I find the same or very, very similar kind of, I think, sensibility in your poetry as well. There's a distinct physicality in it. How much of, you know, I guess, you know, how much of all that is tied into also or informed again, even by your dance and your, you know, your performance background?
Yeah, I think that there's that connection through both threads. And I'm so excited that you pointed that out because now I'm thinking of, you know, the quality of writing for me. Yes, I feel it's physical. It's an active mm-hmm. building right. of the body is involved. The language comes from the body, from the, you know, the resonance of air in the chest and mm-hmm. in the larynx and the vocal cords. So it's a physical art.
It is.
I think we forget, you know, I love Donald Hall has so many wonderful quotes about writing being a physical art, that writing literature is not talking heads. And so
yeah.
I think, you know, in my dancing, I felt that even though I think people often think of modern dance as this, like, you know, I don't know, you know, sort of like high art form. For me, dancing was very much connected to the body. It very much was connected to my father's labor, his physical labor and his work, and, you know, using the body. And that connection was there in the dance, and it's absolutely connected in the writing. And it's sort of like, you know, what's at stake, I think, when you come from working class people. There's a sense of kind of honoring them with your work and keeping that grounded. And then I think that connection to the body is instinctual, and, of course, with dance as well and performance.
And even by extension, the community or the city or our atmosphere that we're surrounded by, you know, I know you're there in New York City, if I'm not mistaken, that's where you're at, right? Right. And, you know,
New York.
And I mean, you know, your language palette here is as rich as walking down a street there, you know, in New York, you know, you know, it really is. And so there's it's just a total sense, sort of total immersion in this. You know, and one of the things I wanted to ask you is, you know, how did poetry find you?
Poetry find me. My father, even though he was a working class guy, he loved literature. He loved Dylan Thomas. He used to recite Dylan Thomas in his pickup truck. He's from that generation, you know, when he grew up in the, you know, 50s and 60s, and Dylan Thomas, of course, was, you know, doing those poetry tours in the 50s. And he also would recite King Lear in his pickup truck.
Wow. That's awesome.
A line from a poem about him.
That's great.
So he helped bring it to me. And so I loved Robert Louis Stevenson nursery rhymes as a kid. And also I went to a wonderful public arts high school, junior high school and high school in Rochester, New York, that's still going strong.
Right.
And I was exposed to creative writing there at a wonderful teacher, Sherry Brown, and she also had a house in Oaxaca, Mexico, and she turned us on to some amazing poets.
Right.
We were reading Lucille Clifton, who was, of course, from Buffalo, so we felt a connection to her. Rochester's an hour away. We were reading Sandra Cisternos, Rosario Castellanos. So we were reading some great stuff in high school and junior high school, and I feel really lucky for that. And,
yeah, that's incredible.
And writing poems, and I was so inspired by my fellow students at that time.
Wow, that's an incredible early exposure. You know, and since we've talked about your father and you've written about him, do you mind if I ask you what his name is?
Stephen Carroll.
Stephen Carroll. Wonderful. And how has your family accepted this collection of poetry? That's always one of those sort of questions I always have in the back of my mind. You know, every time there's a book that comes out, the family is like somehow involved in one way or another. I'm just curious how your family has accepted this book.
It feels good to hear that you have that concern, too. you know, it's funny. As I was working on the book, I would compose a letter to my family in my mind over and over again. You know, the poem is a made thing, you know, you know, try to create that distance.
Totally.
And, you know, I would compose it over and over. And then as I got closer and closer, it became more about, you know, things got busier and deadlines came in, and my family just came in with such support.
Yeah.
I mean, I think at one point I had to explain things to my mom a little bit. I'd say, look, you know, Mom, I'm a poet. Like, you know, I was born this way, you know, like Lady Gaga says, you know, about queer people. I'm not trying to be a diva. You know, I said in some ways I almost wish I had another life. I mean, being a writer, being a poet, it's not easy.
Right.
So after I kind of cued her in, I mean, my mother's a visual artist, but she's just not as much of a verbal person.
Right.
So there was some, you know, talk that we had to have to get on a level. But, you know, my brothers have been so supportive, and I was, you know, worried. You know, my brother's a doctor, and my other brother's in law school, and I was worried that, you know, they wouldn't find value. But, you know, I do have to say there's poems that honor my father, and also the book is dedicated to him. Mm-hmm. That did give me some confidence.
Yes.
To share my work with them, you know, and paying homage. And as poets, you know, that's the work that poetry can do, and that's the work we can do.
Right.
To, you know, to resurrect the beloved and to pay homage
to them. That's right. That's right.
And I think that helped, you know, me feel more comfortable for some of the other material that maybe is a little bit more, you know, challenging or, you know, revealing of, vulnerability or maybe, you know, grounded in like, you know, female experience that brings up shame.
Right.
So the poems from my dad, it helped me to connect to my family and to feel good about asking for their support and receiving it.
Right, right. Well, on that note, would you mind reading a poem? Perhaps one that maybe would you mind reading Mesothelioma?
I'd love to read that one.
Great.
Mesothelioma. Sounds like a species of coral or a flute carved from animal bone. Not lesions on my father's left lung, sheath of hard plaque tumors. Flesh trophies from his labors, six boiler pipes rife with asbestos, installed tiles of this fireproof mineral in housing projects now crumbling, worked decades as a one-man show with a truck of tools and a flimsy mask, barely filtering drywall and joint compound shot through with tremolite filaments. Millimeter fibers latticed his lungs, amassed cells in crazed refrain, rinds of sharp grit binding his breath. Dust clouds followed him home. I costumed myself in his work clothes.
Wonderful. And if you're just tuning in to Words on a Wire, you're listening to the voice of poet Willa Carroll, who's reading from her fantastic collection of poetry titled Nerve Chorus. And the book is out with The Word Works. You know, just in reading the poetry throughout this collection, Willa, and also, you know, just in conversation with you, it sounds like you've had such a really, and by the looks of it in terms of the poems, it's like you've had a really just an interesting life, the way you were raised, the family you've had, and the experiences you've amassed. And, you know, I wonder, and because some of these poems are really tender, like this last one, Mesothelioma, that you just read, you know, did you find that, you know, you, how much time between, you know, these sort of these incidents or these life experiences and to the time of completion of the poem? And, you know, did you find yourself needing to be distanced from that before you're able to write about it with some, you know, effectiveness? Or did you just feel like, you know, some of these just kind of came out in that instant moment? I guess I'm asking more about process.
Right, yes. Well, process is everything for us poets, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting question. And for this poem in particular, and most of the poems about my father's illness in this book, I went to them quickly and directly. Right around the time that he first went into the hospital and we got the diagnosis. And mesothelioma is a very aggressive cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fast. You lived 10 months after diagnosis, which is actually a long time.
Yeah, right, right.
So the poems are really a refuge for me. I guess this is a vulnerable thing. I can't believe I'm about to admit this, but I had an opportunity to take a trip with him that I actually didn't take because I was so caught up in writing these poems.
Wow.
And there was guilt. And I had moments that I stayed that weekend home and wrote these poems instead of spending time with him, but I had to.
Mm-hmm.
I had to deal with the poems in that time.
Right.
And I shared some with him. I think there was a sense of urgency, too, and I wanted to share some of them with him, which was very, very meaningful
for
both of us. It was. I mean, it was difficult. I didn't share all of them. I shared, a small collection because I was still engaged in the process.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there was also a sense of, that I had to prepare. I knew that the grief would be so strong.
Mm-hmm.
I had a feeling that would knock me out, and that did. I really, you know, after he passed away, it was harder to write for a good, you know, I don't know.
Well, I would imagine.
So I saw the sense of urgency in trying to get the poems down on paper.
My grandmother, I'm a little familiar with mesothelioma. My grandmother actually passed away from that as well.
And she was living with us.
Yeah, and she was living with us during the time. I was a teenager, though, so it was many years ago. But yeah, it was a very fast, sort of from the moment she was diagnosed to the moment she passed, happened really fast, in fact. And sudden, just kind of unexpected. So,
can I ask where her exposure was from? Did you know?
You know what? I don't. I honestly don't. In fact, I just learned that this is what took her. But my father shared this with me, I want to say in the last year, barely. Like, so it's, I barely found out that that's what it was, you know, because I was a teenager when that happened. And so I didn't, I had no sense of sort of awareness at that time.
Yeah. Well, asbestos is the cause. That is the only cause.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it is.
Asbestos exposure.
It was asbestos exposure. And I know that it had to do with her line of work, which she was doing, but I just don't know what exactly.
There's many sources. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, your poems definitely pay tribute to not just your father, but your family as well. And so I guess we're out of time already, but what I'd like to do is, I know it happened so fast, especially I have like 1,000 more questions for you, but what I'd like to do is actually leave the listener with you reading another poem from the collection.
Great. Okay. Wonderful. I'd like to read Memorabiliac. I was once a gap-toothed woman, a finger-sucking kid, a locked-up case, a cut peach, a flag in the wind, a weed in the sidewalk crack. I was hungry until mom's paycheck, broken into by the neighbor boys, camped out in the phone booth, half orphaned until my father called. I was once a rider of mastodons, a waitress showing skin, a footprint filled to the brim. I was hustler Ho Emerson Thoreau, player of pin the tail on the honky, a dead man limping, siren wail, siren tail, cilia slung, flagellum propelled, almost mammal. I was once incognito in bed, rust in the wound, mirror in the spoon, fruit too rotten to name, mistress of the survival game. I once heard he still appled my core, pocketed a torch, kept the photograph in a box under the porch.
Wow. Fantastic. That is the voice of poet Willa Carroll reading from her book, Nerve Chorus. Fantastic new collection of poetry that has received just wonderful rave reviews. It's out by The Word Works. Willa, it's been such a pleasure having you and reading this, and I wish you all the best of luck. I don't think you'll need it because this book is just fantastic on its own, but you know, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Tim. It's great to talk to you.
Absolutely. Good luck.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Tim Hernandez, and it's been quite some time since I've done a poetic license, but I figured that I would have the creative license to do poetic license today, and so that's what I'm going to be doing. I wanted to actually talk with you a little bit, folks who are in the El Paso region, about a story that took place in 1948, because I believe that El Pasoans are maybe directly tied to this story, and so that there's some local interest. But in 1948, the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service was deporting 28 Mexicans from Oakland, California to the El Centro San Diego border. The airplane crashed, killed all 32 people aboard, and it later on became a song by the wonderful, iconic American folk singer Woody Guthrie. He wrote a song that was titled Plane Wreck at Los Gatos Deportee. What happened, actually, I should go back a little. What happened was that the media at the time didn't name the Mexican passengers, only named the American four American crew members. They only referred to the Mexican passengers simply as deportees. And so Woody Guthrie wrote a song in which he attempts to assign them fake names to sort of restore their dignity. And in his song lyrics, he says, "Goodbye to my Juan, goodbye Rosalita, adios mis amigos, Jesus y Maria. You won't have a name when you ride that big airplane. All they will call you will be deportee." And that is actually the subject and premise of the book I had been working on for, gosh, since 2010, and it came out finally in 2017. And I think Daniel did a wonderful, we did a wonderful interview, and we talked a little bit about it here on Words on a Wire, I want to say maybe last year around this time. But you know, of the total 32 passengers, my own research and with the help of others, we've been able to find the families for 9 of these people. But lately, a lot of the research points to that they may have actually come through El Paso, Texas. I recently spoke with the family of a man named Salvador Yeo, and he was actually supposed to be on that fated flight that crashed in Los Gatos, but he said that there was a second flight that left, and that flight brought him to El Paso, Texas, and dropped him off here. And so that leads me to believe that a lot of the folks were actually coming through El Paso. And as we know, during the 1930s and 40s, El Paso was one of the big port of entries here, especially during the Bracero program, which was a guest worker program. And here on the UTEP campus, we house the largest Bracero archives in the United States. But it dawned on me to make this appeal to local El Pasoans, because maybe by some, you know, a special synchronicity or perchance, you might be related to one of the families who were in that accident. And if so, please, I'd love for you to contact me here at Words on a Wire, and I'll give you that information when I'm done. But what I'd like to do is actually read the list of names of the families that I have not found yet. And if you find that one of these names here or one of the towns they're from might be related, contact me. Here are the names: Miguel Alvarez Negrete from Puebla, Tomás de Gracia Aviña from Juárez, Elias Macías Trujillo from Ensenada, Baldomero Torres Marcas from Mexicali, Luis Medina López from Michoacán, Manuel Merino Calderón from Puebla, Ignacio Navarro Pérez from Rancho Cerrito, Michoacán, Román Ochoa Ochoa, we don't know where he's from, and then from DF, Polonio Plasencia Ramírez, Alberto Raigosa Carlos, also from DF, Guadalupe Rodríguez, and from Zacatecas, Juan Ruiz Valenzuela y Wenceslao Flores. They were both from Nochislán. Salvador Hernández Sandoval from Zacatecas as well. Severo Medina Lara from Zacatecas. Francisco Duran Llamas. Actually, no, we found the family of Francisco. Let me go now to Jalisco. María Rodríguez Santana. Excuse me there. We also found the family of María. These are just actually the most recent families that I found. But the other families include Martín Navarro Razo from La Barca, Jalisco. Jesús Santos Mesa. from Jalisco, Rosario Estrada Padilla from Guadalajara, Bernabe Garcia Lopez from Jalisco, Santiago Elizondo Garcia from Jalisco, and Jose Macias Rodriguez, also from Jalisco. If any of these names are familiar to you or any of these locations that they're from, please contact us here at the Words on a Wire studio. We are actually writers and poets in action. And you can reach me here at my UTEP email address, tzhernandez@utep.edu. And thank you, and please go out and share the power of your story and share stories and listen to all the stories that are out there. I think we have much more in common than we do differences. Thank you. And we'd like to thank our very special guest today, New York-based poet Willa Carroll, who just came out with her fantastic collection, Nerve Chorus. And that wraps it up for this edition of Words on a Wire. I also like to thank our wonderful producer, Stefania, back there. We hope to see you the same time, same place next week here on KTEP 88.5 FM.